be Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falcon, son of Falcon Screen, and we are joined by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Hello, people.
Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans. Resident 2SCR film critic and broadcaster and everything about town, Stephen Hill.
Howdy.
And we have joining us for especially Ian Barr from Film Club in Darlinghurst and also a Sydney critic and film festival junkie.
Oh, awesome. Thanks for that intro, Glenn.
So we are in the middle of the Sydney Film Festival. We're at the halfway point. It is, we've seen a lot of movies, and we're going to be talking about a lot more on this program and more into the podcast. Five more days left. What we're seeing, what you should see. How's everyone feeling?
Yeah, well, the strange noise I made into the microphone was a reflection of my brain activity being pulverized by punishing films and bad films. It's been a fairly underwhelming festival.
I've had a few really amazing standouts. One
They've
of
been great films, don't get me wrong.
We are going to be talking about on the next episode. Chris and I are very excited to talk about probably one of the biggest ticket items at this festival.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's been some disappointing ones, some very disappointing ones. How do people feel about this festival so far?
Yeah, it always happens, I feel, that, you know, you start a festival with enthusiasm, a lot of energy, and then, you know, there's this mid-festival slump that happens, and then you're just waiting to get through the next day, pretty much, and this is where I'm at, yeah.
I feel like I've kind of structured it, so it's maybe, like, weaker at the beginning, like, things I was maybe less anticipating, and then towards the end, it picks up with the... You know, the more anticipated things. So, but I'm holding out hope that
You have that sort of Cannes release crescendo right near the end. So
yeah,
but I mean, if you don't have those expectations, like there's a few unexpected ones that that's always a lifting thing. It's more when there's the expectation. There's probably been a few films that I thought were going to stand out. Maybe haven't been quite as exceptional as I thought. But there's also been some films that I went to that I wasn't expecting much from and actually delivered. So yeah, a bit of both.
You always have to take a punt at these kinds of festivals.
Yeah,
but
leap
of faith. And that's worked out maybe a couple of times so far, but it feels like across the board it's a little bit of a disappointing program, except for the documentaries.
The documentaries are fantastic. I think they've been standout, and I really, really appreciate how many of them have really, you know, kind of held my interest. Mm. So I need to actually program, you know, make sure my documentary viewing is up to scratch because it hasn't been in the past.
So the first film we are talking about is one that had its local premiere on Sunday night. It is Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale from the director of The Babadook. It is probably, in terms of the mainstream press, the biggest story at this festival because there has been a lot of coverage of the audience reaction to this. Now, we were at the screening. There have been very exaggerated reports of walkouts. There was one report which said a majority of the audience left. This is not true. You would have heard if a majority of the audience left. Certainly, I counted at least on the mezzanine in the Ritz about 5 to 10 people leaving. It's less than half of the amount that have walked out during other films, including High Life, which we'll be going on to talk about. But I think it's very important to recognize that while, as Jennifer Kent has said, it is a legitimate reaction to walk out of a film if you so wish. The fact is, this happens regularly at film festivals, and it's important, especially in the case of a film as controversial such as this, to unpack why.
It's definitely a tough watch. I did find it pretty upsetting. I can't blame people for walking out. I did find it fairly obnoxious when someone went out screaming over the film at a screening with cast and crew in attendance. I think you can do that on social media.
But I think the same thing happened at its Venice premiere, though. There was a very misogynist comment from a press member at the press screening. Though,
yeah, so. From the opposite perspective in this case. This was a person who was upset about violence against women.
At this point, we should give a content warning that we will be discussing in the course of the show in relation to Nightingale and a few other films, issues related to violence and sexual violence and as well as violence against women. To recap on what The Nightingale is, it is set in 1825 in Tasmania, and it is a story of Aisling Franciosky, who was an Irish convict along with a husband who live in an area controlled by their commander and a few other soldiers, played by Slam Kafkaff from The Hunger Games and Damon Harriman. A number of very harrowing events occur, which lead to what has been described by the filmmakers, I think accurately, as a vengeance story, which takes us and the main characters through the Tasmanian wilderness. There have been a number of films at this festival which I feel have dealt with these sorts of issues very poorly and have dealt with it in a either immature or extraneous or even gratuitous manner. I would not put The Nightingale in this category to a great extent because I feel it is a very well-considered film. It is a film that shows the consequences of these actions, whether they be tragic or whether they promote a semblance of a sense of justice. And separate for the issues we have discussed, it is simply a beautifully performed film by Aisling Franciosi and a beautifully shot film. It really captures the Tasmanian wilderness in a way that I've very rarely seen.
I agree. I think the 4x3 framing is used really well. It feels claustrophobic, but also really open and really tall. I thought the camera work is amazing. What's interesting about this film, thinking about it now, is in some ways it's such a visceral experience watching it. There's so much upsetting material in there that it's really a kind of nerve-shaking experience. I can see why people could take this film to task, because when you think about it, this really is kind of like a conventional revenge, almost like an exploitation movie territory. And we can get into questions about to what extent the severity of the violence depicted in this film is necessary, I suppose.
I think it was justified, the violence, not only justified in the sense of how it's portrayed, but also it is making a very important point in a connective tissue, not only about violence against women, but also regarding Aboriginal history.
That's right.
And I think it's a truth which you have to acknowledge. I mean, if you're uncomfortable with it, it's more your problem than the film's problem, to be honest. I think that's what a lot of people don't understand.
I completely agree that not shying away from the violence and depicting atrocities is right for a film which is about historical violence against women, the massacre of the Aboriginal people in Tasmania, as well as just the terrible ways that convicts were treated. But looking back on the film, I could understand why. I mean, when I'm comparing it to exploitation kind of films, those don't have the backdrop of historical atrocities to give weight or justification to this kind of depiction. But they depict the same sorts of things, you know, people being raped and having their family members murdered in order to justify a, you know, go out and kill them all revenge narrative. I think it's a testament to how well written and directed it is that I didn't view the film in those terms. It's only in retrospect that I can see that the contours of the narrative really follow that trend.
I agree. But also at the same time, I didn't see it as a revenge narrative for the most part. I think it is mostly about two cultures coming together in the most unlikely of circumstances. It's actually, I wouldn't classify it as a typical revenge story at all for the most part. And I think it's mostly about trauma and overcoming that. So in that sense, you know, how two cultures with their own respective traumas have to deal with that and come together and still reconcile their differences and still learn something from each other. In that sense, I found it a hopeful story, which is weird because it doesn't seem like a hopeful story in the beginning, but it's actually more hopeful than you realize by the end of it.
I agree with you. I think the relationship between the two leads, the Aboriginal tracker and the Irish convict woman, is so well-written and it's completely believable. There are times that I think there's maybe a little bit of a modern sensibility being projected onto history here in terms of left-wing ideology coming through, but I don't think it's for the most part, I don't think it's too heavy-handed, and I think the characterization and the trajectory is believable. I want to be clear with what I was saying before, that that's just a thought I've been having. I was completely swept away by the film, really, and I think it's incredibly well made. I think it's definitely a progression from The Babadook for Jennifer Kent.
I think it's an incredible film. I also take the view that, and she noted the screening, that this is a film similar to a comment I remember Margaret Atwood making as regards The Handmaid's Tale. There is nothing in this film that is depicted that has not occurred throughout history, and certainly I will never criticize any filmmaker for choosing to tell any particular story.
And I think in terms of the arguments over it, it's how explicit it is. I think if you're going to make a film about that territory, it's not right to shy away, really. I think it's honest.
No, I think there's a lot of films at the festival. I think Judy and Punch we're going to talk about later, I feel, deal with some of these issues, but deal with it in a not very considered manner. This certainly does.
Also, I think it's important to know that this film has Aboriginal input and, you know, involvement in the film, and they're leading this narrative. So it is with their consent, but also from their perspective as much as from a, you know, colonial white perspective. So I think it's important to note that, you know, it's not coming from an outsider perspective as well. So Jennifer Kent has gone through great lengths to actually involve the story, you know, if the Aboriginal story she's telling, and involve the people involved to make sure that she's telling it the right way.
Mm. And I also appreciate that in terms of representing the racism against Indigenous people, that she's gone for some subtleties, that there's this child character that goes along, you know, with who the way that his story develops really, I think, shows how racism is
culturally.
Culturally imbued.
I think just touching on that point, there are a couple of elements of the story which I do necessarily feel as necessary to the end of the film's ends. Certainly the later death of one young character, and you can make an argument that the second sexual assault, certainly the argument has been made, wasn't necessary.
I think it's completely wrong. I think the first sexual assault sequence you could probably cut or leave inferred, but I think the second is making so many points about not just violence against women, but the situation of the characters, and also the situation of the Irish and the situation of convicts in Tasmania.
There's a lot of nuance here, but also it's making a very clear point about violence as a specifically cyclical phenomenon and a specifically male phenomenon. Now, I would recommend people to seek out this film. It is playing again on Sunday the 16th of June at the Dendy Newtown at 6:15 p.m. It is sold out. Usually tickets may become available.
Oh, just one more point. I think on paper this sounds like it could be a really heavy-handed message movie, but it tries to show nuance in its point. The villain is perhaps maybe a little bit too moustache-twirling, but we do have to remember that this is an incredibly brutal period in history, and it has enough nuance to show that men are also victims here. It's not just a movie of demon men versus victim women. It's really about just a hellish environment.
I think even the villain has some nuance to it, especially with his relationship with the child, because you get to see some kind of softness in how he wants to mold the child in some kind of, you know. So there is that relationship that develops, which makes him more nuanced than just a, you know, flat-out black and white villain.
So that is Nightingale. I actually disagree that it's too much of a moustache-twirling role. I would encourage people to look at Journey's End, an excellent film that Sam Claflin made last year, screening at the Veterans Film Festival, see just how brilliant an actor he is. The next film we are talking about premiered at the State Theatre on Monday night, which is Claire Denis' new film, High Life. It is starring Robert Pattinson and Juliette Binoche. It is set contemporaneously, however, in space or whatever time, with time travel and how space dynamics work, that is.
It's at sometime in space.
The descriptions, whether it be in the program or by critics for this film, have been notably oblique. Suffice to say, it is about a group of people who are in space. There are experiments going on, and it, while using a lot of 80s and classical Star Trek style production design, leads to some of the more sinister elements of what could happen if a number of people are left alone for a long time in the vast expanse of our solar system and beyond. Ian, what did we think of High Life?
I'm a huge Claire Denis fan, as I think maybe a few people around this table are. And I think my initial reaction was disappointment, given how long it's been in the making. I think she's been working on it for like 15 years.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was originally meant to be the lead.
Well, Vincent Gallo was actually.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Previously. And it
interesting.
Just, and I mean, the first.
Before he lost his mind.
The first segment of the film is set on the ship as Robert Pattinson attends to a baby. And it's so funny to imagine Vincent Gallo attending to an infant child, like just nursing it. And it's anyway. But yeah, going off track. So after that segment, and I feel the. And then the final segment are kind of the same situation. The bookending segments are Robert Pattinson attending to his child, and it's those scenes are very tender. They're like depicted. There's an amazing performance by that young baby who plays Willow.
I agree.
Yeah. And there's a slightly less amazing performance by the grown up version of that. Character. I thought the middle section, when it turns into a kind of conventional space opera, was probably where it kind of fell apart a bit. Claire Denis, even though she's amazing at so many things, character is not, and like naturalistic, like a naturalistic presentation of drama is not like her strong suit, I think, and it doesn't have to be, because that's not what her films are about. But there are like still a lot of interesting themes throughout. There's the fact that it kind of plays out more like a prison movie than a space one. The design is sort of to evoke some really crappy facility somewhere. And it's also just, I think it deserves credit for just being kind of one of the most oppressive, bleak, horrible looking space films I think I've seen.
Well, I think it continues the sort of existential territory of much of her early work. I don't know if it maybe as effectively as some of her great films, but the, you know, you can go back to Beau Travail, and it all is about people continued sort of operational exercise. So you have all these people that are on death row that are just floating in space.
Yeah, Beau Travail being her French Foreign Legion film, and probably her most famous one. I think there's a lot of structural similarities here, in that it's just about one very lonely member of that kind of program, sort of reflecting back on what went wrong and how it all fell apart and how the group dynamics kind of disintegrated in isolation.
And ending in some kind of big transcendent moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Julia Binoche character is really interesting. Sort of, it was interesting, like that non-fiction, the film we had heard, and she's talking about how as she gets older, you play Fedra. And this is almost like a Fedra-type character, and this sort of person just bursting with passion and wanting, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought a really fascinating role. And I think once she leaves the scene, the last... Even a little bit before, when it becomes a bit more sort of conventional, it kind of loses some of its energy. But before that, I was quite captivated. But there's probably a part around about the two thirds of the way through where it just kind of gets a little too episodic.
I think it's interesting the existential element of it, which you know you can tie back to films like Solaris and Stalker.
Yeah, you can see Solaris influence.
She was a casting director for Tarkovsky at one point as well.
Really? So, wow.
Anyway, I'll throw over to Chris, who I think is a little more negative.
I don't know.
Let's fight about this movie. We haven't been fighting about this any movie actually for a while.
We're entering into
the film agreement.
It's like broad agreement club. Film. Yeah.
This was not great. My view.
I found it to be surprisingly uninteresting visually.
I would agree, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's also the first without her regular cinematographer Agnès Godard, and
yeah.
It really shows. I think there's like a kind of sterility to those images.
There's this flat digital kind of surface to everyone's faces and to the lighting.
Which is probably the point, because it does cut back to the Earth scenes are in this kind of warm 16mm, but it still is pretty oppressive.
Speaking of the Earth scenes, oh my God, there's this, at the moment, there's a, Professor, can you explain what's happening to our characters in space? Yes, well, actually, there's this experiment going on. It talks about all these things that are plainly obvious over the course of the narrative in the film, and I thought it can't just be there for the sake of the exposition. We're going to return to those characters.
It's funny. It's the scene of the sum of all fears with guys just explaining the plot to the camera, or the end scene in Psycho. There's so many bad examples of this throughout history. I'm beginning in Mission Impossible 2. Just bad.
I mean, the funny thing is that I've noticed a lot of critics have been, you know, sort of, some of them have been using, like, this is kind of the stick to bash Christopher Nolan with and his tendencies. And then there's just that one example of just awkward exposition right there in the in that scene, which I actually learned afterwards she fought to include in the film, when it feels like the kind of thing that people force you to include.
Yeah. There's a lot of exposition, though. There's a lot of moments where characters just say, we're low on this, or we need this, or these were the prison circumstances back then, or this is what was happening back on Earth. There's all these just dumps, and they happen in not succession, but throughout the film, and it's always characters trading information, and I feel it was very blatant. It really took me out of it.
This film is about people, you know, stuck in this one state of mind, suffering. But to compare it to Beau Travail, there's a lot more psychological depth. There's a lot more that's inferred, and there's a lot more mystery to that film. Here, I just thought I'm watching a bunch of unpleasant people be horrible to each other, and the same kind of scenarios repeat.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is like a kind of interesting comparison with the idea of a prison, and then the idea of the body as a prison, and then there's like this, you know, very attenuated focus on like the body failing and fluids, secretion and ejaculation and bleeding and whatnot, and it's just about the very inconvenience of having a body and against the vastness of space,
and even the idea of sensuality of it, if you end up with the sort of the virtuality of, you know, the I'm going to borrow the Woody Allen thing, the orgasmatron, where they all go into the to the orgasmatron, but we have this idea of how sensuality has even been altered by, you know, this sort of artificial creation of.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole idea of, you know, modernity and science and how. Yeah.
I got to say that that part was stupid. It's been talked about a lot on the net, like after its premiere.
We're just talking about the box?
The fuck box scene.
I just wanted to use that in case I wasn't allowed to use the language.
That was one of the parts that didn't actually bother me. That made sense to me.
I thought the scene was visually amazing. The editing, the tone, the way that the camera is studying Binoche's body, fantastic. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, the idea of this machine that leaks semen on the floor and someone's got to clean it up is just so dumb.
Also,
I was having flashbacks to Barbarella, and I was like, you know, that was a much more fun, playful way to do it, kind of thing. So, you know,
I will have to say it ends, I think, really quite strongly, and it kind of brought me back to maybe like what I thought was like the emotional core that it was setting.
Sorry,
up.
Are we talking about the film or the orgasmic sequence?
The
okay.
Just so we're clear. Yeah. I actually didn't really like the ending. I feel we were sort of, it's a Giulietta situation where we were robbed a bit of an ending. I get what they were going for, but there was a flourish or multiple flourishes which I weren't necessarily expecting or bestowed upon, or necessarily promised, but I felt it would have made the film much better and would have ended it on a high or on a way that would have made it much more endearing and memorable. In terms of this movie, I liked the performances a lot. I actually liked the set design. It reminded me a lot of the, as I said earlier, of Star Trek.
I can't remember the name of it. It's a pretty renowned visual artist who
Olafur Eliasson.
Yes, right. And so yeah, a lot of thoughts gone into that.
Yeah.
On a small budget.
I've been wondering whether this being made in English had an impact on the actual translation
dialogue
movie.
Is really
the
bad.
Dialogue is really
it's
bad.
Constantly
yeah.
distracting.
Not, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when the scenes are actually silent and they're just, you know, visual poetry kind of in motion, you kind of get into the mood of the movie and then somebody says something and you're suddenly like taken aback, like, oh my God, I'm watching a bad movie. Mm. You know, and suddenly you're reminded of the badness of it all. So it's, yeah, I wonder if it was made in, you know.
I think even the opening scene where there's they're talking, I mean, one of the first words you hear is Robert Pattinson teaching his daughter to say taboo. Uh-huh. Which is kind of setting up a theme, but it's just there to set up a theme, really. And I just that felt really graceless.
To steal a comment from Manola Douglas, this movie does throw out a lot of themes like that that don't, I think, really tie together in a way that's satisfying. Mm. And sometimes I appreciate that kind of scatterbox of, you know, ideas, but approach. But here, the film just felt too aimless for me for a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a little more positive, but it's also maybe just me kind of playing devil's advocate and, you know, being on both sides of the
fence. By all means, we should have someone, you know, more positive about this film because it's been overwhelmingly praised.
It's been overwhelmingly positive.
Except for that at that State Theatre screening where you could just feel...
More walkouts than Nightingales, for sure.
You could feel a sense
of
deflation.
I could hear the audience comments afterwards.
And,
I would have
much preferred to see it the way it was meant to be seen, in an empty theater.
Yes.
in a very solitary.
And yep, or on Netflix in a year.
Stare into the void, and the void will stare back at you.
No, I saw Knight of Cups like that and really enjoyed
it in a very
empty theater. But yeah, actually, you know.
That Knight of Cups screening, that we were there together with Chanel, and we created a new game that me and Chanel were playing during High Life, and also which is Count the Walkouts.
Yeah.
I've done that for a couple of Terrence Malick movies. So this is... So that is High Life. To wrap up discussion about it, the one thing that really got me, and the Barbarella comparison is interesting in that I don't like Barbarella because it has this one specific... not pretty uninteresting tone throughout. This has that too, but the inverse, instead of, it's very mellow. There's no characters really strongly to react to anything they are told, and that's fine once in a while, but you do it consistently. There's nothing for the audience to latch on to, really engage with, and that really bothered me. That is High Life.
Oh, I didn't want to like compare it to Barbarella in any other sense, apart from the Orgasmatron, so don't worry. I mean, please.
One final comparison is you actually hear Robert Pattinson singing the title. The title of the film is a little kind of warbly ballad at the end, which brought to mind Gran Torino and Clint Eastwood singing the title of the film.
I didn't realize that was Robert Pattinson's singing.
It was, yeah. I found that out.
High Life song, wow.
Because it did not sound like Stuart Staples from Tindersticks, who than he usually employs and who did the score as well.
Right, interesting.
So High Life, which takes the cake for the worst roll credits moment at this festival, is screening on Friday night.
No, it doesn't.
Dirty God.
Dirty God does.
Having said that, it's an excellent film. Yeah. And it is premiering tonight. My interview with Sacha Pollock and Vicky Knight is up on the 2SER page and Falcon Screen. Go watch it. It's really great. One of the best films of the festival. High Life is also screening on Saturday at 8:45 at Event Cinemas George Street and Tuesday night 6:15 as part of the Extra Sessions at Dendy Opera Keys. The next film we are talking about is Synonyms, which is an Israeli film from the kindergarten teacher director Nadav Lapid. It is about a gentleman who was in the Israeli military or may still be in active service but in the reserves. I haven't seen the film. Leaves and goes to France, and where he has a lot of challenges as regards his Israeli identity. What did we think of Synonyms?
I thought this was really interesting. I think this is actually one of the best films of the competition, and it's grown in my mind since I've seen it. Partly, I think, because it has so many individual standout scenes, which are very funny and very striking in terms of visuals and conception. I think we're going to talk later on about The Mountain.
I was going to bring up a point of comparison, because there's one film that has just one idea kind of hammered endlessly, and then Synonyms is just this very erratic, going in all directions,
constantly
like just reinventing itself.
Right, and they both kind of have a character who has a kind of studied blankness to them as the lead, but in Synonyms, it's an incredible performance.
Yeah.
You know, so much bottled up rage in this person.
Yeah, it's
trauma, I think.
It's really just, like as soon as you just think of it as a film that is about acting out in a way, it just starts to become really rich, and just the ways this character is acting out and why he is and also just the use of language, the fact that the way it played, the idea of language playing into your identity is just very rich and never really settling on one like kind of thesis.
And that's sort of fascination with the French culture itself. So you've got lots of references to the French New Wave.
Ah, yes, yep.
He's dressed in the orange overcoat, just like Jean-Paul Belmondo. So there's all this like Pierre Lefroux. There's a lot of sort of references to great French films, and you have this really interesting mixture of identity. And also, as the narrative develops, you actually also get the sort of darker elements of the French culture. When they have the citizenship. When they're in that teaching class and they're singing the Marseillaise International.
I thought the young woman's oboe playing was very funny.
Speaking of that French New Wave kind of influence, I really like how they updated the kind of, you know, 16mm news camera go out on the street spirit of the French New Wave with tiny digital cameras. And I think the changing textures of, you know, going from cinema camera to these really gritty and raw, intimate little cameras really works for just the kind of fractured mindset of the
director of it, Nadav Lapid, made a really excellent film called Policeman about 7 years ago, which I'm a little fuzzy on plot details now, but that had a really interesting structure where it was contrasting this kind of like anti-terrorist police unit and like, you know, the more like militant actions of this student, this like little sort of group of students. It was a really impressive film, and I didn't see The Kindergarten Teacher, which was remade with Maggie Gyllenhaal this year.
That was a decent movie. I've
only seen the remake, but I'm keen to revisit that now, because it's Synonyms is just probably one of the best directed films I've seen.
It's so in terms of editing and composition, it's so interesting that it's always creating these kind of like simple frames and then throwing something up or disrupting it with a sudden movement of the camera.
And it's also just letting that central performer
take over the film.
I was kind of like reminded of Leos Carax a bit.
Kind
of very acrobatic sort of quality to it.
Yeah, that's a good comparison. I also think it's really about criticizing, I think, the French culture as at the same time as criticizing the Israeli culture and finding...
But also remaining kind of ambiguous enough that it can still...
it's not a heavy-handed round.
Yeah.
So Synonyms is... it's not screening yet at the festival, but it will be in general release soon. We have to wrap up here. We will be continuing on the podcast, talking a lot more things to the film festival. Subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. And if you're listening now, just keep on listening. I'd like to thank Stephen Hill from 2SER for joining us and continuing the discussion, as well as Ian Barr from Film Club over in Darlinghurst.
No problem.
Listen to the podcast.
Come rent DVDs.
Yeah, so do go to film clubs. It's great.
Spot. Just go there, hang
it's
out.
It's fantastic.
I see you and just chill out there.
Oh, and we're putting on a program as well of Tangerine Dream scored films at Palace Central too.
When can we catch that?
Oh, that starts with Michael Mann's Thief on the 5th of July and then continues like every fortnight.
All right, so this has been Glenn Falcon and Chris Evans of Rotten Rouge. Stay tuned to the podcast. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies and come to film club. Good night.
Bye.
And we're on the Film Fight Club podcast. Just a correction to something I mentioned a moment ago. Maybe Citizens might not be in general release.
I don't think it has a distributor, and it's not a movie that I think plays into the limited range of art house releases we get at in.
It's very interested in not making money.
Yes,
okay. I can't see the marketing.
Like real art.
I can't see the marketing departments getting excited about it. It isn't the sort of cloud praising romantic comedy that you know.
It's okay, guys. That's what real art
it's also no, not
it's,
like
it's, or, the, or, the, or the 60s plus living life to the fullest type. You know?
Yeah,
it's kind of funny building on that. It's a film that's like really just against the idea of cultural tourism.
Yes,
in which is what a lot of like art house offerings in that do actually get a release.
That's hilarious that you say that, because I was about to say it's also not the kind of like gentle uplift family life on the, you know, on the steppe or something like that. Like we're in Mongolia, and here's how the farmers live.
Picture of a cute kid with outstretched arms.
Yeah. It's very much not that.
But it's interesting what it has to say about identity and how it, you know, especially the idea of stories. And I think that's one of the recurring themes in the film, about how the character is about, I give you my stories, and he wants to reclaim it back because he realizes he's given a part of himself away, and how erratic that is. I think in a physical performance, it's a really interesting film.
As you were saying outside when we left, like that speaks to so much of the immigrant experience.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we have a lot of refugee immigrant stories at the festival, but this does something very different to that. And, you know, the way you can do that, it's especially, you know, the citizenship scenes, which Stephen mentioned earlier, I think the absurdity of that is played up really well because, you know,
but also
I've been through
that hilarious
with Australia, so I could hark back to kind of some of those meetings, which is quite funny.
This movie is actually...
If you forget how anti-Semitic the international, like, I mean, those lyrics, the impure... I was like, my golly, I forgot about it. You can see why the National Front always is singing the Marseillaise. I mean,
I think... we should point out how funny this film is. I thought it was hilarious at times. There were a few moments where I saw it separately from Chanel, and she's always my partner in laughing at parts in the movie that no one else realizes are funny. There's a...
I've laughed at a few films.
Yeah, that's true. There's this militaristic Israeli character who gets a rise out of confronting people with his macho Israeli military guyness.
A great scene where he's running through the subway.
Mumbling
the national anthem in people's faces.
I was laughing at that. And the state theater was silent. And then again, Chanel saw it separately to me and laughed at it. And the state theater was silent.
I think I had to watch this movie. That's something that's really interesting to me about film festivals, is people wanting to have the correct reaction.
There's no cues to laugh.
I think that's part of it, where I feel it's more a reflection on the audience and who feel that, is it appropriate to laugh at this or not?
Yeah.
Oh my God, am I being politically incorrect?
Yeah.
Exactly. This scene, am I being anti-Semitic?
I mean, we were talking earlier about the Nightingale reaction and how they're just like, if somebody yells something mid-screening at a film festival, you're going to remember, or at just a film screening, you're going to remember that for the rest of your life. What was it that the person yelled at? Because I haven't seen The Nightingale.
She said something like, I am not watching this. Mm-hmm. And then she said, she's already been raped.
Yes.
And then there was something else she said as she was leaving.
She held an expletive at the film at the end.
You had another story, right?
Right.
Ian, which about somebody screening something and remembering.
Oh, no, that's so goddamn messed up.
Wait.
The Venice story.
I don't remember like what that.
Oh, just that, like apparently that guy a guy was like cheering at violence against Aboriginal people and women, like, yeah. There was a weird laughter at like Shut Up Woman or something later in the film. A guy behind us at the Ritz, like, not only did he laugh at that, which given the context, it should be obvious that wasn't
this,
being played for laughs, but he did this weird laugh that like really high pitched and just kept going. That's what film festivals are all about.
Yep.
One of the best screenings I've ever been
to
is
being challenged, shaken out of your passivity.
No, it's about acceptance, tolerance, and all the wonderful mushy things.
One of the best screenings I've ever been to was Sesame Man, because it was an entire theater of people who got the film and loved it and were laughing the whole way through.
One of the great feuds of Film Fight Club is Glenn versus everybody about Film Fight Club. Sorry. That was a strange Freudian slip. No.
Glenn, I see. Well.
Glenn versus everybody about Swiss Army Man.
Oh, wow. I didn't see Swiss Army Man. So
well, I recommend that you maintain that situation.
Oh, no. It was the best film of 2016 Sydney Film Festival.
It was actually one of the worst films probably ever to play in competition at Sydney Film Fest.
Absolutely not. All time top 50. Easy.
Oh, God.
What?
Easy.
Can you go through the rest of the 50 just to, you've only watched just 49 to save yourself?
Yeah. Well, one of Chris and I saw today, which we'll be talking about next week, may actually be in that list.
Really?
Possibly.
And you liked that much?
Swiss Army Man with that?
We're tiptoeing around this because we're not sure if we can talk about this, but there is a film screening.
It's Parasite by Bong Joon-ho. We'll get into this more... Probably multiple episodes to come.
Multiple episodes.
It's coming to, if you miss it at the festival, it's coming to regular cinemas very soon.
Which is just unprecedented.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, not unprecedented because there are a lot of films will get Korean films will get concurrent releases a lot of the time.
I think whatever we might say about Okja, getting a Netflix release actually, you know, made sure that a lot of people watched it and they realized Bong Joon-ho was a good talent. It may not be the best film, but it did well.
It's
for
strange. Yeah, it's publicity. It's strange. Yeah. I was thinking, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but for winning the Palme d'Or, I don't think this one is particularly, stronger than something like Mother or Memories of Murder. I think Bong Joon-ho has just reached that height after making a few English language films that he's politically acceptable to win a big prize like that.
I mean, there's also the element.
It's a great
film.
Don't get me wrong.
There's also the element of giving a prize so that they work in their native language.
Yeah.
Like, keep doing it. And,
By all means.
Because, I mean, he's like, his Korean films are just incredible.
That's right.
The run from Memories of Murder to The Host to Mother is pretty special.
This is up there.
Yeah.
Without question.
Get excited.
He got a hero's welcome when he got back to Korea. So.
Yeah, and the film's doing amazing business over there, breaking records. So good for Bong Joon-ho. He deserves
commercial
it.
Commercial and artistic success. That's exactly, what we make movies for.
The rare double.
Speaking of Khan and commercial artistic success, our next film is one we discussed last time. However, Ian, we haven't got your take on it, and that is Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory.
Almodovar. We have to do something about it. We keep saying Almodovar, and there is no mold.
What in Pedro.
That's true, but not this one.
I also heard Petra, which was like...
I did not say that. Petra. Ian, save me.
My take on Pain and Glory?
Yes, please.
I thought it was fine. I'm not the biggest Almodovar fan. I mean, I do enjoy his films when I see them, and I kind of nodded off in the middle. Not the film's fault, just my general fatigue.
It happens at festivals.
Yeah, I was only like 2 days in, but maybe just didn't get some sleep. I found it very wise, moving, all those things. Maybe thought it was I saw it actually the evening after The Souvenir, which, as many people have noted, they both share a lot of...
Well, yeah, it was great programming by the festival because I saw them on the Saturday, meaning I got to do the filmmaker autobiography heroine movie Double Bill. The Souvenir, I've seen you have some thoughts on that.
I thought it was... I initially really quite... liked it. I felt maybe a bit distant from it, which is by design because it is, a film that's, I think, sort of, it is, well, first of all, the other big theme is autobiographical films. I think we're going to talk about maybe one in a moment, Our Time. And this one, I thought the treatment of the filmmaker's autobiography, The Souvenir, that is, was maybe just a bit more trickier and more interesting than the kind of more classical way that Almodovar goes back and forth in time. So it's basically The Souvenir plays out in linear time. It's kind of, it does, every scene does have this sort of foggy quality to it because it like begins, with mid-conversation or just, without a lot of context. And it just gives this kind of quality of, just watching a memory as it plays out.
The moments that you remember are so personal to you.
Drained of like a lot of passion too, and that's also quite deliberate, which is maybe like why I think I and maybe some other people I talked to had a kind of delayed response to the overall arc that character experiences.
I do agree with that. It does definitely feel like a person looking back on themselves and not feeling like that person anymore.
Yeah, just not feeling any of the associated passion that they might have felt in the moment.
Which is why I think it would explain some of the sort of, surreal aspects of how you would remember some of those streams of consciousness memories. And I love how it drifted into and out of that. So I think it's an interesting way of framing it. It made the film more interesting structurally than otherwise it would have been, because otherwise it's quite a linear narrative and you don't see that. But the play, that kind of thing, and especially in, you know, sometimes you remember yourself in much more interesting ways than you were actually there. So, you know, when you remember back, you think, oh no, this happened to me, rather than something where you were a part of when that happened.
I thought its treatment of like the addiction subplot and the fact that it was her wealth and his wealth as well that was keeping it going, that, you know, she wasn't in the position to walk out because her very comfortable, privileged living was funding it at the same time, to some extent, like, just funded it until it ran out.
Yeah. It's one of the issues I have with the film, which is also kind of its strength, is that the kind of withdrawn approach to it is applied to a narrative which it's about a person's naivety, so it's a trajectory that really has a foregone conclusion. So that being in this kind of really almost like airless vacuum.
It's actually very funny that we haven't mentioned anything about the plot so far, because it's almost the actual autobiography is kind of secondary to just how it's like, how she's just like sculpting it, I guess. And you know, and she's almost just the only thing she really uses to give that sense of watching a memory is, you know, these like certain ellipses, like the sense of time between certain scenes
and the little handheld flickery.
Yeah. And just like the level of distance and proximity you feel from the characters at any given time. Like there's certain scenes that play out in a very, like, you know, like this romantic music swelling, and then other scenes it's just you know, they're in the corner of the frame.
I really distant. Like, yeah, those kind of distant compositions and just the general atmosphere, I think, do a good job at capturing the strange, again, like kind of vacuum like environment of the wealth. Like a lack of passion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that is Pain and Glory and the Souvenir. Pain and Glory is screening on Saturday the 15th at 8:30 at the Orpheum, and Tuesday at 8:05 at Denzi Opera Keys, whereas the Souvenir is screening on the 14th, this Friday, at 6:15 at the Hayden Orpheum, and on the 16th at 4:45 p.m. at the Rand de Grits. The next film we're talking about is The Mountain, which we caught right before The Nightingale on Sunday night. It is starring Ty Sheridan as a young man who has suffered some tragedy regarding his parents' situation in his life, and becomes under the care, in some senses, of a lobotomist and a doctor in 1950s America, played by Jeff Goldblum. What are the two films we saw tonight? The other being The Nightingale, shot in 4:3 ratio. I liked a lot of the cinematography in this film, even if it didn't tie together, and that's the main issue with this film. None of it tied together. It was dour. It didn't really go anywhere, and remains one of my least favorite of the festival.
Yeah, I was pretty down on it as well, and I was pretty big on his previous two films, which
I definitely preferred Rick
Alverson, yes,
who's he made two films with Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington, aka Neil Hamburger, in his Neil Hamburger persona. So he's been working with these kind of anti-comedy titans, I guess you could say.
But it really makes you wonder how much of what was interesting about the filmmaking was the fusion of his aesthetics with anti-comedy.
Yes, he had a strong kind of persona to play off with and create some friction. And in this case, he doesn't really have that, because Jeff Goldblum is not really the focus of the film.
He's
kind of just, you know, doing his Goldblumisms.
I thought of Jeff Goldblum. They are Goldblumisms, but I thought Jeff Goldblum was good.
He was good. Yes, I enjoyed him. But the main focus is Ty Sheridan, who's deliberately this sort of blank, but not in a really interesting way.
That's right.
I think my main problem is that everything that this film is saying about, like, American hucksterism and these kind of, like, you know, quack medicine types are it's all just built into the premise, and it really coasts on the themes of that premise.
I agree. I've written in my notes, Rick Alverson is asleep at the wheel. it's just basically the shtick of a totally blank Ty Sheridan coasting through weird compositions.
There was a point where I just thought it had to be a kind of meta quality to it, and it was just like the director was was the fraud in this case, and the fact that
so harsh.
The fact that that there is a Vice media logo at the beginning does not help matters.
No, another Vice also financed another film, Judy and Punch, which we're going to talk about later. But regarding The Mountain, what frustrated me, he's playing the role that Barry Keoghan played in Killing the Sacred Deer, a film which I absolutely despised a couple of years ago. And more significantly, the bits, there are some great
But that's
flourishes.
A much better performance as well.
And there was depth to it. The thing about this character, Ty Sheridan here, there's nothing to what he's doing.
And what gets me more is they put the camera on him and Goldblum so much. Goldblum does use a lot of his charm and invert it for dramatic purposes. I do like that. However, they throw them at the camera. They throw the amazing French actor, sorry, I can't remember his name, he does the dancing, who's glorious, but they are hoping some of these images stick enough in your mind. And tonally, some of them are interesting, but tonally, whether it be the drive towards the end, whether it be Sheridan just sitting there, whether it be Goldblum looming over the entire camera, whether it be the amazing dancing sequences, none of them bear any real thematic relevance to it. He hopes it will stick, and it does not.
I mean, I think he's just kind of being, like, mind being charitable, and I'll say that he's being just kind of intuitive with the iconographic associations of both that, you know, that sort of Norman Rockwell vision of America in the 50s, as well as the iconography of people like Denis Levant, Jeff Goldblum. Udo Kier is in it very, like, you know, insignificantly. He doesn't really affect the film in any dramatic level. I mean, you could replace him with somebody else is what I mean. But yeah, I just didn't feel like it offered much.
I think
I just felt like I felt like a normie who wanted to be spoon-fed.
I think
certain points. It would have been a good conventional road movie, I think.
That's right. The story is actually pretty interesting. Hmm. You know, a guy going on the road with a unethical doctor, you know, and touring mental hospitals. And as you say, that kind of like hucksterism. And, you know, the Ty Sheridan really as the innocent seeing this person being praised, maybe entering into his downfall and just getting fed up with it. That's to me, that's a really interesting story. It's just that the presentation is so drained of passion. The only thing of interest really is the compositions. I do think the cinematography is really good.
It is, yeah. It is definitely like, it's a really, actually, I don't know. I thought that even after a while.
It gets old because it's the same approach over and over again.
Yep,
but I do think there were a few really striking moments. But it gets old. But the way that Denis Levant comes in is just kind of like, he's so wacky and crazy. Let's just keep throwing in the crazy, screamy French guy. Do the dance again.
Giving a monologue. Dance.
We need something for another 20 minutes. Please, just do your thing. And
why is this not a short film?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm. So that is The Mountain. I will tell you what it is screening. What is it screening again? It is screening.
Not one of the peaks.
It's not screening again. There you go.
Thank God.
No, it's not that bad. It's just it's just like regular bad.
It's just there.
It's just there. Yeah.
It didn't peak our excitement.
I work as a Jeff Goldblum, and no, just no Jeff. I think I probably enjoyed
Jeff.
Jurassic World.
Oh my God.
More.
Convey my regards if you know him personally.
I didn't say Jurassic World. Was he in it?
At the very beginning, he appeared to say,
life finds a way, and that was it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Because he is the 90s personified. The next one we're talking about is Our Time.
Oh, right.
I'll be honest and say that that I have not finished watching this film yet, but I've got the idea, I think. But I will finish it. This isn't a protest.
I didn't even realize what we were going to be talking about. I mean, I forgot that we were going to be talking about.
Yeah, I just ran out of time, and you know, our time is too valuable.
But how much of it was there antipathy in there, or were you glad to stop watching it?
Look, I was at the point where I was definitely able to see it through. It was really just a question of time. However, I felt like I had passed the peak and was on the descent.
I have to admit, this was a film I went into with very, very low expectations. I'm not a huge fan of Carlos Reygadas, but I do think that all of his films have, there are moments that
there's something of interest
I won't forget.
Every time.
Even his worst films, they are very striking, and I still remember scenes from them years on from seeing them. He did Silent Light, which was here in competition, I think, like 10 years ago, maybe. Yep. And then also a very strange film called Post Tenebris Lux from 2012, I'm pretty sure, that is pretty wild. And this one is, I mean, in addition to not being a huge fan of him, I did not, when I read the premise and heard that
he stars in it,
that this was him performing anxieties and drama of his open relationship, and it was 3 hours long, I just kind of laughed, and it just became this sort of meme in my mind as as it was just perpetually rumored for Cannes and then rejected, and then played at Venice and then got terrible reviews. So all these things were, you know, I had this very negative, this very negative image of it in my head. And I have to say, like, from the opening moment, that scene with the children playing around this, like, sort of lake.
Like in his last two films.
In his last two films. But I mean, I was just immediately immersed in it. And
it was done really, really well. I agree.
There's a scene where, at a symphony, I think, later on, that's just extremely beautiful, where it just cuts away from an actual symphony to a kind of city symphony of sorts in Mexico City.
And also a long, long pan over a mosaic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's another scene which is just attached to a plane as it lands, and you hear a character's internal monologue or a letter or something read over it.
There's also, I didn't make it to the plane, but I did see an incredible scene where the camera shifts deeper into a car.
Mm.
That's
a good scene too.
Right, as sort of in time and leading into a character's sexual fantasies.
I thought those poetic
flourishes are incredible in this film.
Yeah, I just found it even as the drama of it and him playing himself and his wife playing herself as well. Just their domestic squabbles were, if not like interesting in themselves, just like placed in a context where they take on this kind of like grand sort of almost kind of cosmic significance. And it's just like, it's really swinging for the fences and being very earnest and dopey in a way that I kind of found endearing.
Right.
And I just think it's one of the most like singular films at the festival.
It is definitely one of the most singular. I'll say I was really...
You're probably going to hate the ending, I'll say that.
Okay. I was really swept up in the slice of life kind of feeling earlier on, and the long lingering shots. The way that he blocks for the camera is incredible.
Mm. Oh, definitely.
Right. Yeah. Just this uses this really, really wide landscape kind of composition style, which in some ways reminded me of Malick. But unlike Malick, it's very, very much choreographed around the camera. And
very stable. And
yeah,
you know, he settles on landscapes rather than kind of just
flourishes of impressionism.
We've ticked off our two patron saints, David Lynch and Terrence Malick.
We haven't mentioned Lynch yet.
We haven't. Now we have. But, and that's enough.
But I didn't find the domestic stuff so interesting. Like, I think the visual approach that he has been developing has, I think, reached the highest point of sophistication so far here. Some of the compositions and the way characters are arranged around the frame and divided up by pieces of art on the wall, the place that the camera will land at the end of a long scene and just linger. Yeah, it's beautiful, and I agree that it does elevate the drama to an extent, but I was starting to feel my patience tested, like that it's such a kind of mundane by the book. I suppose the scenario is a little bit unusual that for a relationship drama.
It is like a dramatically thin kind of concept.
Yeah,
and there is like a lot of hubris in just assuming that, you know, your like own domestic, relationship troubles are like deserve this kind of like scope.
Yeah,
but I think it just kind of transcends it just by sheer bravado and just the overall sincerity of it. I will say the epilogue of it is very literal in a way that almost made me laugh, but at the same time being like almost like on the edge of laughter and kind of embarrassed at the same time is sort of part of the film. It's just this very like kind of nakedly confessional and I think really beautiful film.
Right.
So yeah, I regardless got the final laugh. I am the cuck in this scenario.
It was funny when they used in the subtitles early on, they say, oh, if only all cucks were like that. And just seeing the word cuck, like, it's like, did the subtitlers realize how loaded that is culturally? But anyway.
So that culturally loaded film, Our Time is screening on
It's about like 4chan posting cattle ranches in Mexico.
On Friday night at 8:05 at Den de Opera Keys. The next film, let's do something non-controversial, not loaded. What's next? Who's seen The Brink?
Oh, yeah.
Well, talking of cocks, I think it's a perfect segue.
Yeah, Steve Bannon. Yeah.
You didn't like it as much as I did, so no. Actually, I'm interested to now hear your opinion, Chris. Bring it on.
Okay, well, Steve Bannon makes a point in the film, which is, he says, Trump taught me that all press is good press. And I think ultimately this film doesn't do that much to challenge Steve Bannon. It's designed for a left-wing audience who will just hear, oh, Steve Bannon's trying to unite the right, and be automatically horrified by that, as if that's enough. But it isn't. Steve Bannon's too good at media, I think, to get pinned down by that. He went in obviously knowing that this is a film project biased against him, and presuming it would work out in his favor, and I think he's right. I think that it's not enough to just put scary music over a montage of what he's been up to lately.
Yeah.
I think a lot of if you're on board with Steve Bannon, you could come away with this, just being happy to hang out with him.
Broader problem in the sense that I don't think anything can harm Trump or Bannon because they're able to basically, flip anything which is against their narrative in their favor, because they just say, look, all these people are out to get me, and, I'm the only messiah that you've got.
Maybe. Well, the thing about Bannon is that this film, reveals, I knew this about him already, but I think a lot of people going in probably wouldn't, is that he's a super charming guy. He isn't good looking, as he talks about in the film, but he has a hell of a lot of charisma. He's able to sway people, and just putting the camera on him as he goes about his business is not going to do what the filmmakers are trying to do.
But in a way, I think it's quite the opposite. I think it's interesting to know that, these supposedly populist leaders who everyone loves to hate are not actually demons. They're actually quite adept at doing their job. And they have this persona.
A skilled manipulator.
Yeah. So I think, in a way, it's more sort of inwardly insightful that you get to see that these people are more part of your myths than you realize.
I guess so. To me, I think a more interesting documentary would have gotten into what is he doing, to manipulate. It basically just shows him at his word. And he is really careful not to reveal anything damaging.
Yeah. He's very clever. And if anything, actually, the left is, I don't know if there is a left anymore in any kind of political context left.
There is.
Glenn. But but it's just that, I think beyond that, it's interesting to see, we like to paint these broad brush pictures around Bannon or Trump or whatever, and that they're evil people. But I think what this documentary sort of gets at, and which is more interesting, is that he's able to do it in a way which is not as blaringly Blairite as people make it out to be. It's not as obvious. It is more in the subtle nuances of how he interacts with people. He makes a very good, personable individual. You would love to hang out with him and grab coffee or
he's much more insidious because he's not the boogeyman. But
Nobody is. Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't think that even the mechanics of how he's going about what he's doing aren't really explored. It just felt very face value to me.
Okay, so that is The Brink. It is screening. I'm just going to bring it up. The Steve Bannon documentary. Oh, where is it? Does anyone know what it's?
Sometimes. There was an Errol.
I see what you're doing.
It's interesting because there was
screening on. It's not screening again. There we go.
Oh, can I bring something that ties it back to some of the films the directors here? 10 years ago, I'm just reading from an article, Bannon saw the distribution of independent films released by Wellspring Media, a company that supported a wide range of international cinema, as well as gay-themed and other transgressive titles. So, Bannon and Wellspring Media, which released films by Hosha Shen and Claire Denis and a bunch of other places. And I think he was just trying to release his own propaganda.
Yeah, because at the beginning of the film, they show a film that he made, which looks pretty bad, and which he's talking about. But man, they released.
Yeah.
Was this just like some tax write-off the producers thing? Like releasing Hosha Shen movies when you're Steve Bannon?
I don't know. I just suddenly remembered that headline.
That's pretty interesting.
We're going to be talking about more films in a moment, but the one we actually haven't seen, which we should note, is the another big story of the festival is the Adam Goodes documentary, The Final Quarter, notably the Melbourne International Film Festival also opening with a documentary about Adam Goodes. There was quite a reception to this at the State Theatre, and also the AFL, in the hours immediately prior to the premiere at the Sydney Film Festival, released an unreserved apology to the handling of the controversy regarding Adam Goodes, who has since retired from the Sydney Swans some years ago. So this is certainly one of the big talking points. I'm meant to see the documentary. That is... We'll be watching that very closely, and we certainly will be seeing the documentary, hopefully, when it comes to MIFF, if it does not get a general release here as well. The next one we are talking about is Reason.
Yeah, Reason. I saw this on Sunday, a four-hour documentary about the rise of right-wing fascism in India, or I like to call it the Modi government, essentially. So it's interesting because a lot of people just don't realize the dynamics of how the left has systematically been wiped out in India completely. There is no left opposition in India right now as we talk about it, and the populist rising from a grassroots level is fascinating to think about it. I think Anand Patwardhan, who's been making movies against the status quo for a long time, about three decades now, systematically about caste issues, class issues, basically the only kind of bastion of the left in India left, India left in the country right now, which is fascinating because, Modi has a lot of soft power and, we get to see the kind of image he likes to portray for the West. But what this documentary does is a great primer from a grassroots level of how these organizations have been set up to brainwash people into believing and rewriting the history of the Indian subcontinent in a way that suits the right-wing agenda, which is fascinating. Think about it. So you have been telling state-based narratives around the killing of Mahatma Gandhi, which suit the right-wing narratives, and how Islamophobia and xenophobia are on the rise, basically funded on grassroots levels by organizations which are then funded by the state, which is a fascinating link-up that leads back to a government-level conspiracy on a grand scale. It's a fascinating documentary, 4 hours. Well worth your time if you can spare it, but yeah, the lack of reason in the country.
And that is screening on Wednesday night, so tonight... Oh, it's already screened, sorry. will not be able to catch it at the festival. But
it's on YouTube.
It is on YouTube in 16 parts, yeah. I would definitely recommend to watch it.
An official upload, it's not even piracy, yeah. So... Okay. There you go.
Because he's never going to get a release in India because the government will never allow it, so he just uploaded it on YouTube himself.
Okay. The next film we're talking about is one we all caught last night together. It might be the only film we've all seen together, and that is The Whistlers. It was a late edition from Cannes. It played as part of the Cannes Critics Week.
It played in the main competition.
Sorry, main competition, excuse me. It is a Romanian drama, comedy, thriller, bit of a genre mashup. I'm very reticent to describe the plot of this because it is one of the only films, not the only film I've seen at this festival, where we are dropped in the middle. But there are a lot of allusions to classics, certainly Hitchcock, Rafiki I picked up, a lot of the early and good Guy Ritchie films. And yeah, Ian, what did we think of...
Psycho.
And Psycho very blatantly. What did we think of The Whistlers?
It was fine. Ian just made a comment when we were talking about it earlier that he is notoriously bad at following intricate plots, and so am I. I was actually surprised that I basically, even with festival fatigue, basically understood what was going on.
I think
in this movie.
I think
bad with heist movies.
I think that little preamble is just, it's deliberately convoluted just to kind of place you in a world where people, like, not even the participants really know what's going on a lot of the time. But
yeah, it's cold. It's got a complicated plot.
I should mention it's by Cornelio Porumboyu, who made a bunch of very kind of droll minimalist films. And this, like, if you've seen any of his films, like, and the moment it starts, you just know that he's obviously trying to challenge himself with like all these very classic noir elements. And
yeah,
it's very dialogue
bring
heavy.
It to something more conventionally cinematic.
Yeah.
Than what he usually does.
It even kind of feels like prestige TV in a way. Almost in a kind of like tongue-in-cheek way because his films are, again, just very, very, very small scale. I quite enjoyed it a bit.
You quite enjoy it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. It is just one of those, just sort of like little souffle things that in the middle of... Festival fatigue. It'll probably get a release, I think.
Yeah, because it's
quite commercial.
Yeah, it's about a gang, coming together to commit a you know, a heist sort of, and double crosses.
And the title refers to the whistling technique that they use to communicate, because cell phones, it's tricky to communicate on cell phones.
Yeah, which ties back in, and it ties back into the searches.
Yes, it
does. Very well, which also blatantly references. I actually quite like the allusions to classic cinema in this, not so much the blatant ones, but the ones that try to riff on the classic idea of the, whether it be the femme fatale, which was handled, I think, better than classic cinema, but not always to such a great extent. A number of the other characters, the one shootout sequence is gold. I think it was my favorite in the film. Mm. It mixed a lot of what we'd expect from modern dramas and modern technical proficiency with the classic Western style. And certainly there is a riff-off of, I'm going to say, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, but any number of Westerns where there is a standoff at one stage in the film, which I think was very well handled. One major detraction to this, and we were going to talk about this later, as mentioned in the podcast, there is a lot of films at this festival which deals with the issue of assault and violence. And I think, well, we've talked about how it is significant that with The Nightingale, it was extremely relevant to either the story they were trying to tell or the arc that was befitting certain characters or the themes that Jennifer Kent or other directors are going for. In this film, there is one particular character who's a very violent character. They establish, purely in his interactions with everyone, that he is an indiscriminate violent character. There's an additional sequence where he assaults the main female character in the film with the use of a gun. And both those sequences, and both separately,
the pool scene.
I'm about to get to that. Mm. Both those sequences establish that this person is a terrible human being. However, there is an additional sequence which is very much extraneous to the plot and didn't need to be included, where he assaults her quite graphically and repeatedly in a pool. Now, this served, I don't believe, any purpose to the film. I don't believe it taught us anything new about the characters. And my feeling is that when these sorts of sequences are included and are absolutely extraneous to the plot and either character or plot developments, then the emphasis is not so much on the consequence but on the violence. And that is a big problem for me. I think the sequence shouldn't have been included. I think it's something that filmmakers and today should be more conscious of, and certainly have been getting a lot more conscious of as public awareness and also the discussions in the press have proliferated on these issues. However, I think this is a film that faulted greatly in this regard by the inclusion of that scene. I think there are other examples, I think more serious examples of this at the Sydney Film Festival this year, which we will go on to discuss.
So Ian will have to leave us soon, but were there any films that you...
Oh, I think the only one I really wanted to shout out was Ray and Liz, which is the photographer Richard Billingham has... It's his debut after, and he's based it on... Well, I mean, it was previously a book of photographs that were based on his life in government housing in England. It's very bleak. It's very stylized. It kind of like reminded me a lot of like Terence Davies films, but like much grimier. It's really impressive. There are things about it that, you know, I mean, just regarding just the attitude towards the characters is, you know, maybe a little tenuous and something I'm kind of puzzling over, but doesn't really detract from the experience of it.
As in it's a kind of negative or scathing depiction?
It is very like unsparing towards his parents in the film,
right,
in a way that is, you know, it's not really like a character driven film. It is more of just like this kind of aesthetic object that is sort of well, presumably very faithful to like the looking through a book of photographs. Mm. Yeah, it's just, you know, sometimes you just got to wonder what the point of all the, working class miserabilism in festivals amounts to.
All right. So that is The Whistlers is playing on Saturday the 15th of June at 6:30 PM at Dante Newtown, and Ray and Liz is screening on Sunday the 16th of June at Denny Opera Keys at 12:05 PM.
I'll try and catch it.
I know you have to pop out, so thank you so much for joining us on the show.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, yeah.
And thank we'll you, everyone.
I have to get back to talk more either film festival, just film more generally.
Yeah.
And go visit Film Club at Darlinghurst.
Film Club is actually amazing. Everyone should go.
Yep.
If you like movies.
The next film we're talking about is Hail Satan, the only film at the festival, maybe the festival ever, to feature a question mark in the title. It is about the Satanic Temple, a group which I think it's Netflix and Sabrina the Teenage Witch have gotten into quite some trouble in for using some of their iconography. It is about this group who, statedly in the documentary, are misunderstood. and about religious pluralism and pluralism more generally, and partly about their efforts to, as there are 10 commandments by statute form at certain state bodies, get their, I can't remember the name of the goat throne guard, but basically place this individual next to the 10 commandments. The argument is, look, if you're going to have it up, we may as well have ours too, and let the Jews and the Christians and the Hindus and everyone else have theirs as well. I liked the unpacking of this organization because I don't know quite a great deal about them. I think it went pretty quickly over some of the maybe more critical aspects. Certainly there is a sequence in the film where they discuss a breakaway of the organization, and I think that was handled quite quickly. I would like to more on that. I'd also like have like more of a breakdown into what extent this group are about specifically about religious pluralism or else, or as statedly from one of the main activists' trolls, and how these dynamics played into each other. Certainly, I think their trolling of, I think it was a state governor, was incredibly funny. I think their approach throughout the court is interesting legalistically as well as it is entertaining. And I got to say, this festival screening of this was one of the funnest that I've attended, because there were a number of lines at event cinemas, and you know, you would ask, "Hail Satan, Hail Satan, Hail Satan," just to make sure you're in the right line. So it was a pretty great environment. I did really enjoy that. So that is Hail Satan. It is screening, I think it's again on, I'll just check. It is screening again on Thursday night at 8:30 p.m. The next film we are talking about, actually, before I forget, just to note, I Am Mother is actually not in cinemas now. It is getting a release in July. It's on Netflix in Australia now. As I mentioned last week, it'll be on a general release in Australian cinemas next month. Thanks, Sean, listener, for pointing that out. Hey, Sean, hope you're enjoying your wonderful trip. The next film we're talking about is one of the two Turkish films which is playing at the festival, which is The Tale of Three Sisters.
All right, so Tale of Three Sisters. I enjoy this film. I think it's okay. So it's very much a portrait of village life, but it mixes sort of comedic and tragic life. But it's very much about the story of three sisters. So sort of similar to the sort of the Chekhovian sort of dynamics of three sisters trying to get autonomy. But we're talking about three women that are in an area where there's limited education, and that struggle to actually gain that sort of.
Yeah, and the hope is to get out of the village and get
into the town,
the town where there's all these opportunities. Yeah. One of the sisters previously had that space and has now returned because she had a child out of wedlock. Yeah. Another, the sister who's been married off into someone in the town, comes back for a while, and old conflicts reemerge. And meanwhile, the sister who had the illegitimate child is married a idiot farmer who ruins everything repeatedly.
Yeah, so it's quite a comic, but there's a tragic dimension to him as well. I mean, it starts with him actually as a shepherd, and he actually is doesn't realize that he's in the dark, and he actually urinates on a grave, and being highly superstitious Turkish, he's really concerned about the sort of, you know, how this augurs for his life.
Yep.
And it is a little bit about the sort of the smallness of village life and how the ability to be able to elude that, and particularly and both of the Turkish films that are at the festival today are focusing on that dimension of. And it is a particular, you know, struggle of how do females escape patriarchal oppression when it comes to this situation of when your role is very much enforced. And this thing is about the three women and their different strategies to try and break out of those sort of defined roles.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, but I think not as much as you. I found it, I guess, a little bit safe. Like, I feel like I understood. I just feel like it doesn't go far enough. It's not a particularly hard-hitting film dramatically. I'm not sure I really have much to say about this one, to be honest. I think it very much felt like maybe it's being a bit harsh to call it festival filler, but it's one of those films that it has the anthropological kind of element to it. It does have it isn't just filler. There is some interest to the clashes between the sisters and the situation with the because, as you say, the shepherd is a tragic figure because when things seem like he might be able to influence, you know, create favorable circumstances for himself, he still manages to ruin things. He just can't. He has a lot of built up resentment and anger and
incredulousness.
And he just can't get a hold of himself, really. I think the characterization was strong. I thought it was a pretty solid film.
And I actually really liked the fact that it didn't go for the overdramatic, overwrought dramatic, and of the tension between the masculine patriarchal figure and the daughters. And whilst he's, you know, the masculine figure is the dominant figure, and you have the village elders and that. The way that he plays out, I mean, his own lack of education himself. And I just thought that the way that it, but yeah, as I said, it probably would have been, there's a lot of interesting things in the background that would have been interesting to probe, but I just thought, yeah, that's...
The scope is, I think, like, fairly nicely contained to five characters, really, and a couple of side characters. I don't have too much to say about it, as I said before, but it's definitely a solid piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, and also the other Turkish film, Sibyl. I mean, we talked about
Whistler. I've seen that on Saturday. I'm really keen.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm considering catching that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of Turkish films recently about, you know, the lack of feminine autonomy. I think Mustangs, we had a couple of years ago, which actually won the audience film. But if you go back to Winter Sleep, has a similar name. And that probably is the great Turkish film of the last decade. But it does seem to be that there are a lot of films focusing on rural Turkey and the daily life, and just the powerlessness, where it is much more predominant because of lack of opportunity for education.
So that is A Tale of Three Sisters. It is not screening at the festival, but I think it may be available online, iTunes, elsewhere.
It seems like the kind of film that might actually get a small release. Maybe not, but
maybe.
Possibly. There is a Turkish Film Festival. Maybe it'll also pop up.
Yes, that is coming up later in the year. Maybe it will. In our last section of the show, we've talked about some of our favorite films of the festival, but it is incumbent on us to talk about some of the least favorite films and ones that you should perhaps avoid or not see. Steve, we might start with you. What are some of your, we talked about highlights, what are some of your lowlights of this year's Sydney Film Festival?
Okay, well, I feel a little unfair. It's always hard, because there are some merits in this, but I just think it was the wrong environment. For Walden, it was a film that was shown late in the day, I think it was on the Friday, so those people that had sat through 7.5 hours of Satan Tango and then went and saw Walden, I'm not sure many of them would have stayed awake, and I struggled to maintain, you know, to shake off Morpheus in that period. I don't know that it was meant to be a film that was meant to be watched in one thing, and that it wasn't. I think it's actually unfair.
Yeah,
some of this criticism.
I think the Sydney Film Festival keeps making this really strange decision of programming video art in a cinema, and you sit down and watch it when it was not designed. They did this last year with The Bare Necessities, or whatever it was, The Pure Necessity, and there was another.
The Bare Pure Necessity.
Right. There was another film, or there are a few others that were video.
Image Book.
That were video art.
No,
the Image Book is still.
Image Book is art. Image, come on.
The Image Book is video art ish, but it's still designed and works as a film you sit down and watch in the cinema, and it guides you through from a beginning to an ending. Whereas a lot of these things are meant to be, I think, just seen at random intervals playing on a wall, and you can watch for as long as you want or come back to it later.
Yeah.
As an art gallery installation, it's not doing any favor to these works to program them in a cinema. Why aren't they just, you know, setting up a section in the hub with headphones for you to watch these films, maybe?
Actually, that would be a good way to do it.
Put them on the wall.
It reminds me of the Cate Blanchett film that screened, which is actually already screening at the New South Wales Art Gallery in several segments.
Yeah. Manifesto.
Which was great to see at the Art Gallery.
Yes,
itself.
It was.
But
I could digest it. I could watch a couple,
go
to the cafe.
Go see something else and come back.
Go see my favourite Degas and then go back.
I definitely would agree with that. I mean, it did have some really lovely pans, and you could draw into it for like 20 minutes, but there was actually nothing to sort of focus the action. And most interesting, and then the last 20 minutes is quite interesting when it actually goes to the Brazilian Amazon, and there's actual people and there's movement.
So this is tracking
it's a continuation of
long tracking shots.
It's just a continuation of 12 tracking shots,
and so
it's a continuation of the logs from an Austrian forest, I believe it is, across Europe, And the journey all the way
across, existential journey of a log.
Yeah.
I think conceptually that sounds great.
Just, about logs and wood. Yeah. All right, so that is...
My heavy wooden heart.
So that is... What time is... I'll look up the time that's screening.
Because we've really sold you on it now, haven't we?
If you feel like getting up...
I had the movement of a log in that.
If you feel like getting up on Saturday morning and going to Circular Quay, it's playing at 10 a.m. at Dendy Opera Keys.
It might be the sort of thing in the morning when you are fresh.
Hey, fresh every day, I want to see a log's journey today. This is exactly what I want to do.
It's just at the end of a day, of a long day when you...
We'll log that one. All right. So
I logged off. Sorry, I had to do the bad part.
You just chipped in with that one there. So the next one we're talking about, Chris, do you have one to nominate?
I think the absolute worst film of the festival. There've been some really bad ones. There's another really bad one I want to talk about in a moment. But the absolute worst of the fest has to be Slam. Slam is sold, or is as having something to do with the Bankstown Poetry Slam and a particularly one particular politically engaged poet. But it's actually about this boring guy moping around after she disappears. It's made in this superficially arty style where everything's slowed down, and if the general slow pace of the film isn't enough, it tries to underline important moments in slow motion. This film has the poisonous combination of extreme seriousness of intent and of style. Everything's completely dour. I was surprised to learn that the director has previously made films in India and France and has only recently moved to Australia because, oh God, does this feel like, in the worst possible ways, a stereotypical Australian film? Like, this is a serious drama and everyone's really serious and it's just lacking all vigor or life. This film barely has a pulse.
It's the biggest compliment for most Australian films, actually. Thank you, Chris.
So it's the poisonous combination of that extreme seriousness and just ludicrousness in the plot. In order to make a statement about racism against Muslims in Australia, which should be a pretty easy thing to write a plot about, this director makes incredible leaps. It's a story where the main character is meant to be a guy who's turned his back on his heritage, and while his sister's the really politically engaged person, he's essentially wants to live the conventional life like any white person in Australia would. But somehow he ends up getting arrested in connection with a crime that there's no evidence that it's actually been committed, when the media drums up a controversy about his disappeared sister leaving to join ISIS. I would think that someone would put the brakes on this, even in in the heightened political atmosphere that the director attempts to create of fears about ISIS. But no, this guy gets arrested by a SWAT team in front of a bunch of media. And when has this ever happened in Sydney? It has no relation to Australian life. It has no relation to the real ways that racism expresses itself in Australia. And it's so tonally all over the place. After hours of this extreme self-seriousness about things that would never, ever, ever happen, it ends in this this burst of exploitation schlock, like a 70s cheap grindhouse movie. It's just so, so, so bad. I can barely believe it. I would say that this film, look, it's for a very low budget production, it's well shot. The lead actress is good. But really, I'm searching for something good to say. I'd say this is a film without redeeming features.
Well, clearly, you got to see it now, right? So, yeah. So, Slam is screening this weekend. Watch it.
It's premiering this weekend. It's premiering Saturday the 15th of June.
Okay.
At 2:05 p.m. at the State Theatre.
Oh, God, I can't stop hating on this movie. It's the disappeared woman sounds interesting. So instead of making a movie about her and the world of the Bankstown Poetry Slam, which I bet most of the people who went to see this movie went in because of the interest in that, we spend this time on the world's most boring man and his boring family and boring friends.
played by Adam Bakri from Omar, which is a fascinating film.
And great movie.
Right. I know. But I
haven't seen anything since then.
I don't know, Chris. Maybe you're making it sound more interesting than it is.
I just don't understand why you wouldn't make the film about the politically engaged Muslim poet in Sydney. Like, that's interesting. This isn't.
I think you should have watched the film that he made rather than wanting him to make another film which he didn't make.
I did watch the film that he made, and all I can do is imagine better ones because everything is wanting.
Or go to the Bagstown Poetry Slam, which is actually really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good environment. And the other times it
there's
is
no
screening.
There's no poetry in this movie. There's like one poem that's
there's no poetry?
Repeated. There's one poem that you hear like four times.
Dear me. Okay. All right.
You've got to go ahead and watch it now because we've sold it so well. We've done a brilliant job. Actually, that's Chris, as a what you would call a dissenting review.
Yep.
This did much better for the film publicity than any. I think most of our listeners
all
would
right,
be very excited.
All right, then fine. Go out
and
see
one.
Slam. Get slammed.
At Sunday at 4 p.m.
Something.
Because you're the powerhouse. Or Sunday, 7:15 p.m. at the Ritz in Randwick. That is the Poetry Slam movie called Slam Without Slam
that's
Poetry.
Not the Poetry Slam movie.
I'm getting to that.
Also Saturday at the State.
I said that first.
And there is a Poetry Slam at the Hub after right after.
That I want to go to.
Breaths.
That I want to see.
I'm restraining myself.
All right, so that is Slam for Rut.
It's hard to follow that up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. This is a film I can only think of more bad things about. How do you go? I won't be able to top it. But Virat.
Look, initially I was going to go with my favorite, actor of all time, Dave Patel, and The Wedding Guest, which was pretty bad. But then I thought I'd try to not play to my stereotype and try to pick something different. So Ghost Town Anthology, which I saw on the first night of the festival, was absolutely horrid.
We needed a couple of strong drinks after this and we got them.
Yeah, we had some really warm mulled wine right across the road at Blackbird, which I'm more happy to talk about because I think that's more interesting than the actual film that we saw, unfortunately.
God, this is bad.
And this was preceded so by a short, which is also equally bad. Hugh Bo, who made Elephant Sitting Still, his last short, premiered as a double feature with Ghost Town Anthology. And I think that should have been a giveaway for me that I was having a horrible night and I did. What's the problem with this film is, much like Chris and his perception of this other film that I'm not going to talk about, I think with Ghost Town Anthology, the film ended after 8 or 10 minutes and it didn't know what to do after that. And it just kept on going and going and going. And you just waited for something to happen and nothing interesting happened. And when things eventually happened in the climax or near the climax, they were tackled in such a drab, cheesy way with such on-the-nose heavy symbolism that you just thought just. And this film has interesting things to say about politics and, you know, how little ghost towns are being left in the waste, but it doesn't do them any justice. It doesn't tackle any of these actual underlying issues that it thinks it's tackling, and that's probably the worst part about it, because there is some wasted potential and wasted potential and wasted potential.
It's just, it's very rare you see a film which handles storytelling so well for a stretch and then just goes in a completely opposite direction. I can't believe the amount spent on poor character development, exposition, and also the ghosts. They just weren't interesting. They treated it as this massive reveal, and they all basically mostly took place for a stretch in one person's house. The staging wasn't particularly endearing. And then when it got to the symbolism, think of the final scene as the Andrew Garfield's character is lowered down in Hacksaw Ridge, or the scene in Spider-Man 2, a film I'm not actually a big fan of, where Peter Parker is carried through the train after the actual one really good sequence where he stopped the train from going off the rails. It's basically on that level, but it's so painstaking how much they linger on it.
Yeah, this film kind of merges into another film that we saw a couple of years ago called A Ghost Story, and it takes the worst elements of that film and mixes the worst elements of this other film, which is its own film, and then makes an even worse film. But which is like, you know, I didn't think that was possible.
What? Oh, God.
But then it just
had its charm.
But a ghost story, it was a good film.
But I'm just talking about, you know, the worst lingering shots
people.
The ghost of a ghost story is bad.
That's another fight. We should save that for a retrospective film festival fight. Maybe a Swiss Army Man ghost story.
I counted 36. Right.
Nice. No, actually, you were playing the game.
But I was enjoying myself.
That was the year with Swiss Army Man, right?
That was 2017 ghost story. Swiss Army Man was 2016. There were three walkouts of Swiss Army Man.
Okay, no, I'm just thinking. We should do a retrospective worst of film fight.
Worst of Sydney Film Festival.
Yeah.
Of all time.
Where we all picked Swiss Army Man and Glenn picks it as his favourite.
Yes. Yes.
I'd go for that. I'd love that.
So Ghost Town Anthology was one. And the other one, obviously, as I mentioned, The Wedding Guest with my favourite actor, Dave Patel, because, you know, he's doing amazing work right now and he needs to be encouraged to do more amazing work.
It's not a great movie.
I know. But, like, there are people who just refuse to... I want to meet these people and, like, sit them down and, like, pat them and, like, give them a warm hug. Because I'm just like, it's okay, guys. You can admit that Dave Patel is making bad movies. I just feel like, I don't know what these guys are saying. I mean, he's an incredible actor, yes, but he's just in terrible projects. He just needs to, you know, just do some acting and less shirtless things, which is okay for like 2 minutes, but then just pick a better movie.
I was just going to say, Michael Winterbottom, how did... I mean, I just...
Yeah, this was...
Potentially. I just
I found a few of his movies, like Trisha, I also found pretty boring a few years
that,
back.
The remake of the Thomas Hardy.
This was just similarly lacking in drive as that film was.
Creativity. There's nothing new about this movie.
It's very generic.
Yeah, it's beyond safe to the point of complacency. Mm. It's just people will go to see this because these are the people involved. You need to do better than that if you're going to be a marquee film at any number of cinemas.
I mean, it completed a hat trick for me with Lion, Hotel Mumbai, and now it's like the worst of, like, you know,
worst of Dev Patel.
It's really good. I mean, like,
sorry, the best exotic Marigold Hotel is a lot worse than Lion.
Yeah, but okay, maybe it's even poor Quartet. Like, how do I quantify the hate for Dave Patel and, you know, the stretch
poor
of time?
Man.
Quadrilogy.
Quadrilogy.
But, you can have a box set of it with your critic quote on the front.
But, like, actually, to be honest, I got to admit, like, Dave Patel has been keeping my critic dreams alive because I feel like the only written reviews that get published of mine have been Dave Patel's in the recent past. So, actually, I got to give him credit for keep doing the movies you're doing because you're really keeping my career alive. So, thank you, Dave Patel.
So, shout out to Dave Patel there.
Oh, I want to mention another bad one I saw just briefly. Monos. This was just... Okay, Ian, before, when I asked him what he thought about this movie, he said, maybe it's because I was just watching it as a screener late at night, but I kind of like half like checked out and half watched it. But I saw it in the State Theater and I kind of checked out and half watched it because it's just so boring. You saw it as well,
yeah,
right, Stephen?
I didn't quite have that sort of... I thought it had some flaws, but I thought it had some interesting things about... I mean, it is very much a Lord of the Flies recreation. I thought that interesting thing was the roles of the different characters of this sort of palace child soldiers. But there's some frustrating things, like, I mean, this whole overwrought dramaticism is the thing that really was frustrating. And the sound would go up at the most obvious moments.
Yeah.
Of tension. So you had to be sort of led... And yet there was enough dramatic aspects.
Sounds like here comes hell.
The issue for me is I just didn't find the characters interesting. I thought it was going for this just, you know, fairly obvious war is hell kind of point and over-laboring it with, a lot of, like, big shock sound design.
Yeah.
And
I see that. You see, a lot
to try to, like, jolt you.
A lot of plays you get, in those bad production of plays where they go with the big overwhelming loud noise, you go, this is dramatic.
If anyone who saw the recent Sydney Theatre Company production of Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, you'll know exactly what they're referring to. I'm seeing this on Saturday, I think. It's the
Monos
screening at 6:45
Well, I guess
Newtown.
We can talk about it more after then, but it was like misery porn to me, you know? Like, what's the point of it?
I'd mildly disagree with that because I do think that there are some redeeming aspects of the sort of powerlessness of child soldiers. And I think the characterization is difficult because they are still children and they've never been given a chance to really develop. Mm. And it is kind of that sort of savagery, that man gone wild type aspect, that sort of Hobbesian sort of all against all, the sort of the sort of aspect and the sort of uncontrollable, and how that sort of totally psychically crushes the characters. And there's that interesting thing of, like, characters like Rambo, who is probably the most gentle character, is assigned the role Rambo. He's the most reluctant warrior in the thing. It's probably over-labored, but there is some interesting elements in that, in the different characters. It's just that it's just gone too much for the let's play the drama.
I skipped Monos, thankfully, because of Chris and his recommendation. Right. But it gave me the most unintentional laugh of the entire Sydney Film Festival with the tweet that the Sydney Film Festival put out promoting the film. He said, the child soldiers are here. ... And I just...
I saw that.
That was hilarious. It's like, that was hilarious.
Like, someone's been fired.
I didn't see the whole tweet. In fairness, I didn't see the whole tweet, so I'm not sure what the rest of the tweet said.
Was it just, yay, child soldiers? Come and see them at the film festival. The child soldiers are here.
And then the Monos. It's
kind of like how that short like the British are coming, except the science the child soldiers.
The British are child children.
Not completely different, totally different about this comedy involving this local.
Like, I appreciated a good laugh. Like, you know, good on you, Sydney Film Festival social media person, whoever did that tweet. You know,
right.
Yeah, you have a good career ahead of you.
So the last film we're talking about, dear God, is a film called Judy and Punch. It is an Australian premiere. It is a film Vic story, and it's post-produced in New South Wales. It is from Australia's Mira Folks. It is starring Mia Wasikowska and Damon Herriman. Our interview with Mira is up on the 2SER page on Festivus and Falcon Screen, and it has a couple more screenings throughout the festival. It's incredibly disquieting and disturbing that there are two films that played in the same day at the Sydney Film Festival, both funded by Australian state agencies, both starring Damon Herriman in the role of an abuser, which both feature graphic deaths of children. Like, just stop and think about that for a sec. That's really strange.
How is that allowed to happen? Why did no one say these two films are kind of similar, and one's from a very first time director and by the sounds of it had obvious script problems, and one's from an already internationally acclaimed up and coming Australian auteur? It's not going to do any favors to finance both of them, right?
No, I mean, there are coincidences at festivals, certainly, and there are two SA Film Corp films, one of which is The Nightingale, which has strong Irish influence. I remember the one year that the two Bolivian films about at MIFF, where Daniel Radcliffe film and the other film
was
about
Cargo?
No, it was the one about getting lost in the Bolivian jungle. There were two different
jungle
effects, and Lost City of Z, cool, and Jungle, both screened on the same day. That's fine, but this was a little stranger. But having said that, Judy and Punch is one that I think it's unfortunate that The Nightingale has gotten a lot of the negative press it has. And I think a film like Judy and Punch highlights just what was so considered and well depicted and well executed in The Nightingale versus what comparatively was not done so in Judy and Punch. The comparisons don't stop there. Both main female leads, both are described as a female-driven revenge story, go into the nearby forest to get local people who have been shunned to help them take revenge against those who have done the wrong and harmed them and their family. But having said that, the comparisons really stop there. This isn't a genre mashup, it's a tonal mashup. It plays very fast and loose with tones. The three main actors are in three very different movies. Mia Wasikowska, fairly given what has happened to her character, is playing it very seriously. Damon Herriman is shifting unseasonably between very serious and a light lukewarm comedy. The combination does not work. And another character who's playing the main cop is playing it as if he was Hugh Laurie in a bit of Fry and Laurie, and none of it tonally makes any sense. I encourage you to look up my full piece on this on over on Falcon Screen. But the issue with this film, there are many. Going back to the tonal elements, there is a sequence later where a character manages a Matrix-level Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon physical stunt, the likes of which have not been included in any of the sequences that are thus preceded it. I understand the premises itself is really interesting, the idea that you're doing an inversion of the classical Punch and Judy story, which is a story about a man who is assaulting his wife and looking at examining some of the issues therein. However, the approach the film takes and the tonal confluence, which is very clear and very muddled, does not take a discernible stand on how the film feels about violence. And I feel, for reasons discussed previously in regards to extraneous violence, I feel it has the effect for casual viewers of glamorizing or championing it rather than dealing with the consequences thereof. That is a very serious problem. I feel there's an entire subplot involving an abuse of a secondary female character who is not Judy, which has no bearing on the outcome of events, and therefore, again, you have to question why this was included. It doesn't tell us anything about Punch's character. We already know he's an indiscriminate abuser of both men and women from his treatment of others. And if this is included, the focus becomes more on the violence and on the consequence. And that is a serious issue which people should be aware of when constructing films, certainly when deciding which films to choose. Moreover,
to the treatment of some of the other victims of Punch's actions in this film, there, and I understand this is played for comedic effect, but there is a very showy reveal that happens at the end of the film, which could just as well have resulted in the harm to these characters. And it's one thing to say that we're going for a fun, irreverent movie, or as was stated in the Sydney Film Festival guide, a batshit crazy one. That's an actual quote. But you can't just say a film is funny or outrageous. You have to, I mean, the comparisons at this point are very common with Tarantino, but Tarantino and directors of his ilk, when they depict violence, either depict it in such an exaggerated, clearly exaggerated form to emphasize the inhumanity of it, or depict the consequences of it, whether it be a semblance of justice or whether it be tragic for those who would seek to use violence in a form of vengeance to account for violence against them or others. There's a lot more, except the film, the staging of the forest sequences were lousy and made absolutely no sense logically.
Hearing Glenn, I haven't seen it, but hearing Glenn talk about this film the other day, I just thought the combination of Tarantino-esque pop culture references and extremely graphic depiction of violence against women.
And children
sounds in so bad taste. Oh my God. I can't see that possibly working in any way, but...
I'm just kind of in awe of the fact that you then went on to interview the director and did a bloody good job of it. So that's very kind.
Look, I mean, I was really curious for this interview because I was curious to what perspective she approached it from, and I wanted to unpack some of the issues. So a lot of my questions around depiction of violence and else in the films put to her, and that interview is up on the 2SCR page. People can listen to it.
Yeah, I recommend people listen to that rather than go watch this amazing atrocity.
So that is Judy.
Batshit crazy atrocity, actually.
Batshit crazy and fun. Before we wrap up, are there any movies we haven't covered?
I just want to note when Judy and Punch is screening. It is screening again tomorrow night, Thursday at 6:30 p.m. at the Round Regrets.
Before we wrap up, I was just wondering, are there any films we haven't spoken about that you just want to throw in a quick recommendation for?
Oh, before we do that, I just want to note, I should in fairness note what is good about this film, and that is Mia Wasikowska. She's excellent as always. Some of the set design is quite decent, particularly in the main town, and there is an excellent one-liner involving how a bunch of ruffians are experts at obtaining confessions, which I think everyone in the cinema laughed at. So I will give the film that, but it stops there.
Fair enough.
So, Chris, what's your question?
Yeah, so just before we wrap up, are there any films we haven't mentioned that you just in briefly, for anyone who might be listening, want to throw out a recommendation for that are still upcoming, maybe?
If you like African cinema, Akasha is playing. It's a Ugandan film about a comedy about soldiers who are on leave. There's half their budget, I think, was on one shot during a drug-addled sequence. There's a fantastic supporting actor who helps the guy out. It has a very trademark dark African humor, which I appreciate and have appreciated since a very young age. So if you're looking for an African film at the cinema, there's always a few good ones at the Sydney Film Festival. You should check out that one.
Yep. Ritesh Patra's follow-up to the Lunchbox Photograph, which is playing in the State at Friday 4:30, just before the Jim Jarmusch Dead Don't Die. I would recommend that double. It's going to be pretty fantastic. Jim Jarmusch for other reasons, but Photograph is a much interesting, more mellow take on how a photographer and an unlikely person come together in the most unlikely circumstances. If you've seen The Lunchbox, which is his previous film, it's a very warm take on relationships of unlikely people coming together and finding meaning in each other. So if you like that kind of cinema, and that was a smash out hit because of the audience liking. So if you're looking at the film, which you can, you know, as an audience member, you want to go out and take a chance at, this is probably one of those films which is quite a safe bet for you and not one of those, you know, risky bets at the film festivals which people look out for.
I really enjoyed In Fabric. I think
really want to see this.
Yeah, I was surprised. Did you get to catch it?
No, I didn't.
I was surprised at how much I liked it. It's got a great combination of the kind of retro kitsch and comedy sourced from that. But at the same time, it also plays that kind of retro throwback style seriously. There's a great balance of comedy and actually unsettling horror. I love the way this is put together visually with this kind of frilly feminine style, which, along with a bunch of other moments in this film, feels very indebted to Suspiria. The second half of the film doesn't work as well as the first half for me, and I really think it should have been trimmed down. It's still good, but the first half manages to evoke empathy for its characters, and the second half goes for a more easy style of comedy rooted in condescension. And I think for that reason, it there just isn't as much sustaining it anymore, and it, in terms of the horror, basically repeats itself. But it remains funny and it remains visually inventive. So with that disclaimer, I'd still really recommend it. I also think some of the documentaries, just quickly, Martha, A Picture Story, is a really warm portrait of a cult hero, essentially a woman who documented the rise of graffiti culture when no one else was interested in the subject and received, you know, changed people's lives, but has no recognition outside of that area of interest, essentially. And she's an amazing interview subject. She's 70 years old and just full of life, always doing interesting things for the camera, like the opposite of Steve Bannon in that regard. No media training as the director, who's an Australian, and it is an Australian production, as she mentioned in the Q&A after the screening. The American Factory is also very good. It's about a Fuyao, a Chinese glass manufacturer for car windshields and windows, trying to open up a factory in America to replace a employ people who were left out of work after General Motors shuttered. This film, it takes an obvious perspective on the side of American values, the union movement, who are of course very incompatible with the Chinese overlords of this factory, but I think despite having a clear point of view, I think it was fair. I think it tries to give voice to all sides, and it tries to understand where these kinds of fundamental disagreements are rooted.
All right. I mean, there's a few that I think these have already been shown, but things like Clean Up, The Deposit, and Retrospect, I think three films that
we haven't covered any of those.
It'd be great to cover at some time. But yeah, of the films that are still coming, I think the Brazilian film Divine Love is certainly a film that... a sort of satirical look,
yeah,
and a sort of futuristic look. I mean,
we actually caught Divine Love. I think all of us have seen it now,
yes,
right?
We've all seen it. Yeah,
we may as well talk about it now.
We can talk
if
about
we've
it
got
now.
Time.
Yeah, Divine Love is the film from the director of Neon Bull.
I don't think it's as good as Neon Bull, which was one of my favorite films of recent years. But I think this one's good.
It's a Brazilian sci-fi set in the near future about a group called Divino Amor, Divine Love, which it uses sexual therapy to promote an evangelical connection between you, your partner, and God,
and the
church.
And it's set within a context where evangelical politics seem to have taken over.
Bureaucracy of the
and
actual...
And
mass-produced.
Yeah. I mean, the best scene in this film is when she just goes through a drive-through chapel.
I thought that was fantastic.
Oh,
because
so good. And just the idea of just subtly including what is futuristic. I remember the first X-Men film did this quite well. Just subtly, this is what the future is, rather than saying, you're now in the year 2023 and these are the advancements. I really liked. I didn't like the film as much in the second half. I feel that it went too long getting to the plot.
I don't mind that it's too long getting to the plot, because I think it's really not a plot-based film. It's really about sketches and interludes. It's really more about the location than it is about the plot. The issue for me is more it's that in the second half these sketches repeat themselves. I'd be okay with watching a purely kind of interlude and sketch based movie, like a Roy Anderson style, if you saw a pigeon set on a branch reflecting on existence. But the issue is that in the second half, you know, the point has well and truly been made, I think, and most of the, instead of expanding the world further, I had a lot of questions about how this world works, and there are many aspects of the society and the belief structure and of this cult, Divine, or I'm not even sure if they are a cult or how state sanctioned
Divine Love. It's actually quite interesting how...
Actually, the sex scenes were very well filmed.
Yeah. I was going to get to that.
I was just going to talk about the structuring of how the actual narrative is actually structured between the sort of relationship of the main character who works at the bureaucracy and her husband and their desire to have a baby and how fertility is sort of fetishized. I just thought it was interesting in the sort of all these sex scenes is how the fetishization of the body, and I thought that was really interestingly drawn. And then the sort of emptiness of their relationship, of the sort of how they've sort of combined the sort of the cult of sort of evangelism with the sort of cult of the body. I thought that was
And ultimately it shows how empty their belief system is. Glenn mentioned earlier this scene in a drive-through. I think it showed that, you know, a woman comes through with genuine questions of theology and they don't actually have any answer to it, so their response is to blare up the sensory overwhelming, you know, turn up the lights, turn up the music until you just feel a sense of awe and go on your way. And by the end of the film, when a huge theological issue comes up for the main character, she's pretty much rejected completely. There's nobody there to understand her. And it shows that, even the value system that this state is claiming to be upholding, they fail to.
She's referred to an almost an Orwellian type body. She's told to check in. I mean, you have these things where they go through scanners.
Yeah.
And so I just thought this idea of, and it is interesting with, the films like The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it is a very interesting, particularly, and with the
changing
down on women's body, and we just with the Brazilian politics too, with the transformation. I mean, that has to be talked, and we talk about some of the Brazilian films in the festival, and this was certainly one of the ones which was really good.
On that subject, Bacurau coming up,
Bacurau, which I'm really looking forward to carrying, but just avoid Marighella if you can.
I really liked how this film drew an analogy between the mass bureaucracy of government and what had become the mass bureaucracy of religion. They're very interlinked in this, but elements we can see there of both in different countries were brought to the fore here, and I think it was artistically very well done. Also, what was artistically very well done was the sex scenes. Usually, sex scenes are filmed at are quite intimate or quite flashy or have a lot of jump cuts. These are filmed at a remove, drenched with neon, and just allowed the actors to progress throughout the sequences very intricately in several well-staged ones in different environments.
The choreography of the sex scenes is fantastic.
Yeah.
And the music, that sort of climactic, really bad dance music, which is sort of false climax of, which is, also ties into the sort of happy clappism of evangelism. It really did look at the sort of holiness of this idea that you could just create your own religious world without really dealing with the big spiritual questions of life. That's exactly right. Are off.
Yeah, it's really like the kind of like Hillsong approach on a mass scale. Mm. But yeah, the sex scenes are striking both in, as Glenn was talking about, like the distance, but also they're just really well choreographed. They're really physical in ways that you don't usually see on screen. Completely believable. And just striking and beautiful to watch, really.
So I don't think Divine Love's playing again as part of the festival.
Yes, it is. Thursday night.
Oh, fantastic. Yes. One to catch up on.
Good catch.
A couple.
And now the other one I mentioned, the doco, is briefly Shooting the Mafia. I just think it deserves it's a good 80-minute, 90-minute documentary about a photographer that documented some of the Palermo, during the all the killings during the 80s and 90s, which, of course, included armed judges that were involved in trying to prosecute. I think it's very interesting, and it is not just about the sort of the tragedy of how much damage Torres Nostra did on the people in Palermo and adjoining stations. Also a very interesting story of life. Her own personal story is quite a captivating film of this woman who actually escapes from growing up from the oppression, the very patriarchal oppression of her society, and quite interestingly then has a degree of interesting relationship with lots of young male lovers. So I thought it was a really good film to catch for 80 minutes.
Another couple of flicks I've managed to catch: The Wind, playing as part of the Freak Me Out section. A couple of excellent performers. It has one of the best jump scares of any film I've seen this year, or actually for quite some time. Staged very well. It combines ideas of Western frontier and horror to great effect in many sequences. Some of the cinematography is gorgeous. However, I feel it really falls back on tried and tested tropes of this genre towards the second half. Certainly the role of a preacher who rocks up. And it's a bottle thriller. I'd recommend it if you are a fan of horror. The other one I caught is Animals, which is the Sophie Hyde film, the Irish-Australian co-production that was financed out of Adelaide. It is starring Holiday Granger and Aaliyah Shawkat.
Would you really recommend it, though?
Animals? I haven't got to recommending it or not yet. What I would say is I like this film a lot, and I didn't mind a lot of the craft. However, I would say that the subject matter is more interesting than a lot of the execution. I found the very blatant explanations by the Aaliyah Shawkat character about what was going on to be very frustrating, particularly a sequence where royals is deployed to sum up the moral of the film was very well done. Having said that, while it did show a lot of what was going on in Dublin and the music and cultural scene, I feel that it was simply transposed from Manchester to Dublin, the original novel, and isn't as lived in about Dublin as maybe many of the films that screened at the Irish Film Festival were, including Dublin Old School, which I'd recommend checking out.
I don't want to keep the podcast going too much longer because, man, we've gone for a long time, but I wanted to tell you guys to see, I'd like to discuss this when you guys have seen it, because you really should see it. It's got an extra, it's sold out on Saturday night, but there's an extra screening at Monday night, which has been added. Midnight Family, which is an absolutely amazing documentary. So hopefully we can discuss that in future. Anthropocene was also really good. So is One Child Nation. It's a great, great year for documentaries. The documentaries have been way stronger than the fiction films in general.
So thank you for joining us for our Sydney Film Festival coverage. And thank you, Stephen, for joining us and Ian Barr. We have been discussing a lot of serious issues on this episode. So if you do, if there is someone you would like to speak to about any of the issues raised in the course of this program, the number for Respect is 1-800-RESPECT. That is 1-800-737-732. And they are a service that discusses people impacted by violence and family violence and assault. Thank you for everyone for joining us. We'll be back on Sunday at midday with much more Sydney Film Festival coverage, including our review of the much anticipated Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, as well as many more.
Baccarat.
And Baccarat. Mm. And many more. This has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, Stephen Hill, Ian Barr, and Virat Nehru. Have a wonderful night or morning or whenever you're listening. Enjoy movies. Have a good night.
Live movies, love movies, repeat.